place is the first of all beings, since everything that exists is in a place and cannot exist without a place. Good morning, and welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan, Kansas. We are a welcoming community, and you are welcome in this place. Whatever your faith, whatever your walk in life, you are welcome here. In that spirit of inclusion, please take a moment to greet the people on either side of you, around you. If this is your first time visiting our fellowship, we welcome you and hope that you can stay for coffee and conversation after the service. If you are considering becoming a member or have questions about membership, please talk to our welcoming and membership committee chair, Shirley Hobrock. Shirley, would you just raise your hand? Yeah. Okay. We light a chalice that burns throughout the service. This morning's chalice lighter is William Lott. William, would you please come forward and light the chalice? In lighting this chalice, we celebrate the fire that unites us all, from the molten core of our planet to the fusion of hydrogen and stars throwing off heat and light, to the fire in the nucleus of each cell and every plant and animal. We all live by burning bright, by shedding our collective light for all to see. Please stand as you are able as we sing hymn 1008, When Our Heart Is in a Holy Place.
Thank you.
It's my great pleasure to introduce our guest, minister in training, Jordan Nelson Long, a seminarian at Meadville Lombard Theological School in Chicago, an intern at All Souls KC in Kansas City, and a mother of two boys, a wife. She is also a fellow for pastoral care at the Church of the Larger Fellowship, the UU Church Without Walls, and she blogs about family and faith life at raisingfaith.net. Her topic today is Hope for the Long Haul. Our announcements today, I would draw your attention to the Sunday Bulletin. Please read them to find out what's happening at the fellowship. I do have one announcement that was handed to me. This is about next week. UUFM members will be voting on a resolution concerning racial profiling in Riley County. I think most of you are aware of this. If you would like a copy of the proposal, there are copies on the coffee sale table. This was also in the last newsletter. Now it's time for joys and concerns. Because we are a caring community, we take this moment to acknowledge the joys and concerns of our fellowship. If you would like to briefly state a joy or concern from your life, please raise your hand so that the microphone can be brought to you.
Good morning. My joy today is that last night we had a wonderful Valentine's Day contra dance, and we now have monthly contra dances in this town, which is a real boon to the community. And I invite you all to come on the second Saturday of every month and check with me if you want to know.
Springboger, I have two concerns. One about my friend Lydia. She's in hospice now. She has cancer, and she's going to be leaving us soon. She's in Alabama right now. She's a good friend of mine. And two, my brother, he applied for increasing his disability through the VA, and they denied him on all counts. So he's getting a lawyer, so, yeah. There you go.
Michael Oldfather, and several days ago I was conflicted because I had a choice either to apply for a part-time job or to seek advice from a mental health professional. I have not seen I've seen Dick, but he was no help. and I now am the director of the music director at all, what is the name of that? Meadowlark Hills, the choral director, and I may need to see that health care provider soon. Oh, one more thing. For 18 years, I did it on a volunteer basis. I am now a paid, professional choral director.
Hi, I'm Jane Pelletier. Yesterday, several members of the fellowship made their way to Topeka to demonstrate against Brownback's pulling back on protections for LGBT state workers. There were about 700 people in attendance on the Capitol steps, and it was very upbeat, very inspiring, and I'm glad we had a chance to go. There were UU members from Topeka there. I don't know about Lawrence or anybody, but Betty and I and Chris saw the UU members from Topeka carrying Standing on the Side of Love little placards, so we were able to identify them. And then also I'd like to acknowledge that Barbara Hacker is back with us. Glad to have her back.
Okay. Thank you for sharing your joys and concerns. The choir will now perform I Sing Out, led by Michael Oldfather. Thank you.
so I'd love for the young and young at heart to come have a seat. Good morning, you guys. Did you like that song? I have a story for you that is about another way that we can sing out. It is a story for kids, but I think we might find that it's actually a story for all of us, and it is called One by Catherine Otoshi. I'll hold it up so you guys can see. I want you to think while we read if you've experienced anything like this before. Blue was a quiet color. He enjoyed looking up at the sky, floating on the waves, and on days when he felt daring, he also liked splashing in rain puddles. Blue is a peaceful guy. Every once in a while, Blue wished that he could be more sunny, like yellow, or bright, like green, more regal, like purple. Do you guys know what regal means? Anybody? Regal is another word for royal. It means you're like a king or a queen. Can you guys hold yourselves regally? He wished he could be regal like purple or outgoing like orange. But overall, he liked being blue, except when he was with red. Uh-oh. Red was a hothead. He liked to pick on Blue. Red is a great color, he would say. Red is hot. Blue is not. And then Blue would feel badly about being blue. Do you guys see Blue? How does he look in this picture? He looks kind of flat, doesn't he? You guys ever felt like a flat puddle? Yeah, sad. Blue didn't feel good about being blue around red. Sometimes yellow would comfort Blue. Blue is a very nice color, she would say. But yellow never said that in front of red. She also never said, "Stop picking on Blue." Green and purple and orange thought blue was nice, too. Do you think they told red to stop? No, they didn't either. Every time red said something mean and no one spoke up, what happened? He got bigger and bigger and bigger. Soon, Red was so big that everyone was afraid of him. No one dared to stop him, and then Red picked not just on Blue, but on all of the colors. And then everyone felt a little blue. Until One came. One had a different shape with bold strokes and squared corners. He was funny. He made the other colors laugh. Red saw this. How do you think he felt?
Very mad.
Yeah, Red got hot. He was mad. "Stop laughing," he told Yellow. "Stop laughing," he told Green. "Stop laughing," he told Purple and Orange. And they did. Red rolled up to One next. "Stop laughing," he said. But One stood up straight like an arrow. Can you guys sit up straight? He sat up straight like an arrow and he said, "No." Let's try that.
"No."
One more time.
"No."
Right. Red was mad, but One wouldn't budge. And so Red rolled away. One turned to the other colors and he said, "If someone is mean and picks on me, I, for one, say no." And then Yellow felt brave and said, "Me too." What happened to Yellow? He turned into a two. Green agreed and said, "Me three." And Purple became four. Orange became five. Blue saw the other colors change. He wanted to count. Meanwhile, Red grew hot. He felt left out. He grew hotter and hotter and hotter. Uh-oh. Red raced over to Blue and said what he always did. "Red is hot. Blue is not." But this time Blue stood up tall and he became six. "Red can be really hot," Blue said. "But Blue can be super cool." I wonder what's about to happen. Red blew a fuse, and he tried to roll right over Blue. This time, though, everyone took a stand, and what do you think they said?
No.
Let's do that again.
No.
Right. Seeing them standing tall, it made Red feel very, very, very small. And then Red turned even redder, and he began to roll away. What do you guys think? Should we let him go? I think our first principal might have something to say about how we need to treat Red now. Blue called out, "Can Red be hot and Blue be cool?" And Red stopped right in his tracks. "Red can count too," said one. You're exactly right. Red rocked and he rolled and he turned into seven. "Everyone counts," they shouted. And then Red laughed and he joined in the fun. Sometimes it just takes one. I want you guys to think about that while we sing you out to your classes.
Oh, in love.
Accept the offering.
So there are sometimes we need to say no, but we were asked to share a poem with you titled "Say Yes" by Andrea Gibson.
When two violins are placed in a room,
if a chord on one violin is struck,
the other violin will sound the note.
If this is your definition of hope,
this is for you. For the ones who know how powerful we are,
who know we can sound the music in the people around us
simply by playing our own strings.
For the ones who sing life into broken wings,
open their chests and offer their breath
as wind on a still day when nothing seems to be moving.
Spare those intent on proving God is dead.
For you, when your fingers are red
from clutching your heart
so it will beat faster.
For the time you mastered the art of giving yourself for the sake of someone else.
For the ones who have felt what it is to crush the lies.
And lift truth so high, the steeples bow to the sky.
This
is for you. This is also for the people who wake early to watch flowers bloom.
Who notice the moon at noon on a day when the world
has slapped them in the face with its lack of light.
For the mothers who feed their children first
and thirst for nothing when they're full.
This is for those who showed me the hardest thing about having nothing is having nothing to give. Who said the only reason to live is to give ourselves away? So this is for the day we'll quit our jobs and work for something real.
We'll feel for sunshine in the shadows. Look for sun rays in the shade. This is for the people who rattle the cage that slave wage built, and for the ones who didn't know the filth until tonight. But right now, our beginning songs that sound something like people turning their porch lights on and calling the homeless back home.
This is for all the shit we own.
And for the day we'll learn how much we have.
When we learn to give that shit away.
This is for doubt becoming faith.
For falling from grace and climbing back up.
For trading our silver platters for something that matters.
Like the gold that shines from our hands when we hold each other.
This is for the grandmother who walked 1,000 miles on broken glass to find that single patch of grass to plant a family tree, where the fruit would grow to laugh.
For the ones who knew the math of war has always been subtraction, so they live like an action of addition.
For when you give like every star is wishing on you,
and for the people still wishing on stars,
this is for you, too.
This is for the time you went through hell so someone else wouldn't have to.
For the time you taught a 14-year-old girl, she was powerful.
For the time that you taught a 14-year-old boy, he was beautiful.
For the radical anarchist asking a Republican to dance.
Because what's the chance of everyone moving from right to left?
If the only moves they see are NBC and CBS.
This is for the no becoming yes, for scars becoming breath, for saying I love you to people who will never say it to us.
For scraping away the rust and remembering how to shine. For the dime you gave away when you didn't have a penny. For the many beautiful things we do.
For every song we've ever sung. For refusing to believe in miracles because miracles are the impossible becoming true.
And everything is possible. This is for the possibility that guides us.
And for the possibilities still waiting to sing.
And spread their wings inside us.
Because tonight Saturn is on his knees.
Proposing with all of his 10,000 rings.
That whatever song we've been singing, we sing even more. The world needs us right now more than it ever
has before. Pull all your strings.
Play every chord.
If you're writing letters to the prisoners,
tear down those bars.
If you're handing out flashlights in the dark,
start handing out stars.
Never go a second hushing the percussion of your heart.
Play loud. Play like you know the clouds have left too many people cold and you're the last chance for sun. Play like there's no time for hoping brighter days will come. Play like the apocalypse is only 4, 3, 2.
But you have a drum on your chest that could save us. You have a song like a breath that could raise us, like the sunrise into a dark sky that cries to be blue. Play like you know we won't survive if you don't, but we will if you do.
Play like Saturn is on his knees, proposing with all his 10,000 rings, that we give every single breath. This is for saying yes.
This is for saying yes. One day, a few weeks ago, my younger son invited me to see the jail he had built out of his Legos. Silas is 4. He pointed with his tiny fingers to the place where the people who are bad are captured, and then he told me a story. These people were building a city, and they found an old jail in the woods. So they took it, because everybody needs to put people in jail. And then they built their city around it. I'm so proud. As Silas chattered on, I wondered what future awaits him. What future
awaits all of us. These have been discouraging months, many in a row. From the overwhelming awe and heartbreak that some of us may have felt at reading the new Jim Crow, coming to understand the scope and depth of the incarceration and inequity in our country. To Ferguson, to Michael Garner, to Ferguson again, to make no mention of systemic voter disenfranchisement, the widening income gap, Ebola, measles, and the 3,000-pound gorilla of environmental destruction and climate change. I have to tell you, I wonder, in the face of all of this, what this particular, peculiar religious upbringing is giving my children and yours. What does our Unitarian Universalist faith have to say about living into this broken, beautiful, unequal world? And what are we doing here in the face of all of that on Sunday morning in this space? I think of the work that has been done recently in this movement to try to understand why our young, the Unitarian Universalists who are raised in this faith, they so often don't stay with us. The question is complex, and yet I wonder if the answer might not actually be very simple. Theories that have been thrown out include that we spend too much time trying to explain to those outside of our movement what we even are, or that we spend even more time trying to agree here in our congregations on who we even are. And meanwhile, we lack flashy holidays and gory special effects. We can neither entice you with the magical promises of heaven nor threaten you with hell. Those are interesting ideas, but it's deeper than that. The truth is this: being a Unitarian Universalist, it's hard. Digging deep into this faith will change the way that you see things. Things will turn from black and white, the kind of easy answers that play well at the Thanksgiving table or the bowling alley, into shades of gray. Many shades, more than 50. As a practicing Unitarian Universalist, you will be called to reject easy answers, the ones that seem very obvious to most everyone else. You will be called to make yourselves uncomfortable sometimes, voluntarily, and then we'll ask you to invite your friends to do it as well. Wow. And so I wonder, what can I offer to either of my young sons to make any of this palatable, to make church, this church, and transformative sacrifice appealing in a society that tells us constantly that you put your quarter in and then you kick that machine until it gives you your gumball? How do I get the message across that actually you often have to wait a while, palm outstretched, for that gumball to drop? That sometimes your gumball is going to cost 50 cents and the person behind you will get theirs for free, because we are a people who believe that equity is what justice looks like. That once in a while you won't get a gumball at all, and we will call your quarter an investment in the future, one that you personally might never see. I think there is an answer, and it's not that this church is only for practicing masochists. What if what is needed in our faith is to connect deeply with joy? And what if we help each other to do that by coming here every week? the other side of digging in our heels to stand on the side of love, as so many of you did yesterday in Topeka, it can be a deep weariness. You may want to just stop walking, stop caring, or at least give your forehead some keyboard as you read the latest gospel according to Facebook. What we need is comfort. And I'm going to share with you in a moment a vision of what might comfort us as we take a stand against the deepening divide between rich and poor, against environmental destruction, and against institutionalized racism. I also want to talk, though, about what comforts us in these smaller, simpler moments of our day-to-day lives, and about what church has to do with that. Americans are working longer hours than ever. Meanwhile, wages in the last 10 years have remained stagnant when considered against inflation. The poorest in our nation have actually lost ground. The middle class, too, is often feeling the pinch. Perhaps you are. My family, too, we've added a kid since the crash of 2008, and meanwhile, nothing seems to go as far. I raise this because it is fertile ground for scarcity mentality to take hold. There's not enough right now, and there might be even less tomorrow, or so we tell ourselves. Insert the 24-hour news cycle and connective technologies that we either cannot or don't want to turn off. Add also politics at every level that has become more dollar-driven than ever before. Politics that have learned that fear is an excellent motivational tool. Put all of these things together, add a cumulative lack of sleep, a loss of meaningful touch or deep relationship with family or community. My people, we are wired to react to negative stimulus in this moment. The world at the beginning of 2015 can feel threatening and unsafe, even without unrest and injustice on the scale of Ferguson. But is this how we want to live? And is it even true? Did you know that violent crime is at its lowest level since 1978, right now? And that is number of crimes. If we consider percentages, the average person is actually less likely to be murdered, assaulted, mugged, or brutalized, at least by people not in power, now than at almost any point in American history. That's true. But do you feel that way? And do you see our local police departments acting like that's true? Why are our four-year-olds building us jails, if this is our context? Did you know also that we threw away enough food, and I don't mean dinner scraps, I'm talking about mass dumping, profit-driven, at the corporate level, enough food to feed all of the food insecure, that's what we now call hungry, that's 50 million people, all of them, just by reducing that food waste by half. What's with the scarcity mentality? Did you know also that educational attainment is up, with 90% of our students nationwide graduating from high school for the first time ever last year? Did you know that life expectancy in the United States hit a record high in 2014? We indeed need to check our privilege, share the wealth, fight for justice. All is not lost, though. So does church matter in combating the relentless messages of fear and shortfall, in framing a better way to live? You bet it does. Where else are you hearing this message? Who else is going to say this to you this week? We need to be here. We need to be together. And we need this place as a fulcrum for our weeks and as a framing for our lives. But hearing a new message is just a starting point. We then have to find a different way of living, and we need comfort that gives us the strength to try it. What we are dealing with here is called compassion burnout, and the treatment is threefold. First, we have to nourish ourselves, our bodies, and our spirits. Second, we need to change our definition of success. And third, the most critical, we must know that what we can do, that it's enough. Looking to that first point, I hope that rituals that you participate in here, in this community, are part of what nourish you. When you meet for coffee hour or break bread together before a meeting, you're nourishing yourselves, your bodies, also your souls. The airlines have a phrase for this. They call it putting on your own oxygen mask. The idea is that in the event of an unexpected difficulty, you need to put your own mask on first. You have to attend to yourself, not eventually when you get around to it. You have to do it first. Only then can you count on being in a position to help others. Here, too, you take care of yourselves that you may leave strengthened to care for the world. And soul nourishment is not just about food. We feed ourselves with beauty. We feed ourselves with rest. Knowing this, what care can you offer to yourself this week? What can you do to feed your soul? Our second task moves from using our bodies to using our brains. We are going to change that definition of success. Our very own Unitarian Universalist theologian, Dr. Sharon Welch, she's one of my professors at Meadville Lombard, she takes this on in her book, A Feminist Ethic of Risk. It might surprise you to learn that this is not actually a book about feminism. It's about reclaiming the definition of success from a traditional winner-take-all, the problem is solved, or we failed business model. What we know is that challenges as complex as racism, poverty, and gun violence, they're what social theorists are starting to call wicked problems. They have multiple and hidden causes, deep interrelationships with other challenges. Under the traditional way of looking at things, they're unsolvable. In other words, it's hopeless. Except, Welch says, this is a ridiculous way of looking at the world, at our world, the only one we have. If our way of seeing solutions means that we can't make things better, the option is not to give up. It's to find a different way. Welch challenges us to acknowledge that we are told every day that we are powerless to change things, and that there are forces in this country with a deep interest in us believing that. She says that our job is then not just to fight injustice, but to fight the larger sense of disempowerment that stops people from moving when they could. The feminist part of the book is a reframing of what progress means. We have to let go of the idea that things are only worth doing if we are likely to succeed, to see clear and swift fruits of our labors. It is instead the struggle that is noble, and it is that same struggle over a long time and in the face of long odds that changes things. This is important, and it matters on an individual level also, which brings me to our third task, the heart task, the faith task, and we are people of faith. We must know that what we each can do, the efforts of our own small hands, that they are indeed enough. Perhaps you've heard that starfish story. The man is walking on a beach, and he sees another man picking up one starfish at a time, throwing them back into the sea. The first man gazes up and down the beach, noticing that there must be hundreds, maybe 1,000 starfish all stuck on the sand. There is no way that either of the men could save them all. No one could. The futility is so obvious that you wouldn't even call it discouragement. The onlooker simply feels no call to help in the face of this sort of losing battle. And yet he cannot help but ask the starfish thrower what he is doing. Why do you invest the time to throw them back? You cannot possibly make a difference here. And the first man, we are told, doesn't break stride. He simply grabs hold of another starfish, tosses it into the sea, and says, "It made a difference to that one." I confess that I have heard that starfish story so many times that my first thought when someone asks me about it is, please don't tell me that again. The truth is, though, there is much wisdom in the tale, underlying principles that our faith traditions have recognized for a very long time. The Benedictine Catholics, for example, call it radical hospitality. They follow the example of monks receiving visitors at a monastery, insisting that we each help the one in our path and view that person as sent to us by God, helping them worrying not about whether helping that one weary traveler eases burdens for all travelers everywhere. In fact, Benedictine spirituality says that it is not for us to ask that question. We are simply called, in their words, to be God's hands and feet here on earth for the ones next to us. The Benedictines feel that that gesture made with the inner peace of great faith, it's enough. There is beauty in that, and yet, as Unitarian Universalists, we might feel called to something else. We might feel that that question, how do we address the larger problem, that's our question. And I don't disagree. And so I'm going to tell you one more fish story. Perhaps you remember the movie Finding Nemo. It is a Disney Pixar animated feature from 2003. Toward the end of the movie, a bunch of sardines are caught in a net that is being hoisted from the sea at the end of a crane. The fish are heavy and the crane is struggling a bit with the load, but what is needed for those fish to escape, and this is all told from the fish's perspective, what's needed is extra force. The problem, though, is that all of the 1,000 fish caught in the net are swimming in different directions. They are panicked, they're confused, they're acting as frightened individuals. Nemo, a young clownfish who has struggled up to this point to find his identity as a leader, he's caught in that net too. But he's small enough to escape. And rather than fleeing, he sees what must be done, and he sticks around at great risk to himself to try to convince the other fish to save themselves. And what can save them is so very simple. Swim down together. Nemo's voice isn't enough, though. He needs others to be speaking that same truth. And so he swims in and out of the net, telling every fish he touches, tell everyone. Tell everyone to swim down together. And you know what? Those fish do it. First a few, and then more, and then all of them. And does that remind you of anything? Hundreds of thousands of voices speaking out in favor of Planned Parenthood, leading to a reversal within 24 hours of the Komen Foundation's decision to defund them. federal and then state and then local judges acting in favor of marriage for everyone and voices from this congregation speaking up alongside that. The tide is turning because of your voices. More than 1 million people speaking out to tell their stories before the health care bill became a reality, something that politicians said could never be done. There is so much out there to convince us that our voices do not matter, that we're licked before we even start, that things are going from bad to worse, and the only way we can even cope is to shut that still small voice inside of us up. Be ours a religion that counters the toxic belief that one voice of dissent doesn't matter. Be ours a faith that models the heart and courage to act not in isolation and fear, but together. Be ours a church that helps us to pause and be nourished, that we may leave comforted and strengthened to take one more step. Until there is peace in the streets and peace in the homes, and until our 4-year-olds stop building us jails and start building us stars. We have work to do, and our first task is to keep hope alive. Amen.
We have time for a couple of comments, so if you'd like to comment, please raise your hand. The microphone will be brought to you.
My name is Jessica Sievers. I would like to thank Sarah and Alex for your poem. That really hit home here. Okay, but you pulled it off splendidly. Jordan, oh wow, thank you so much. Most of you know that I'm a nurse, and your one-liner, put your mask on first. Please, I implore everybody to do that, because I was talking with one of my coworkers, a night nurse. She's a wonderful person. We call her Mother Mary because she's just full of grace. And she was talking about how she got to know one of her patients really well. And she said to them, I wish you took care of yourself as well as I do to you. And people don't realize that if you don't take care of yourself, the burden falls on someone else, whether it's a loved one or somebody in my position, you know, that's paid to do that. Part of our, you know, deficit is because of healthcare. There's so much that can be done with preventative care. I love my job, I do, but it's so devastating to see what happens when you don't put your own mask on first. And thank you for mentioning the positive things. I think we really needed to hear that today. We're too focused on the negatives.
May we put your sermon on our website?
Sure.
Thank you.
You'll want to run that by Michael, obviously, but...
This is Marissa Larson. I just wanted to share how proud I am of my son. He's 7 years old. He's in first grade, and he's already dealing with trying to stand up and for himself and for others. He came home and jokingly said a phrase of, you know, he screams like a girl, and I explained to him how that was not proper, that it's insulting to girls as well as the person that, you know, they're trying to be insulted. And once he understood, he felt horrible. And then the next day we're getting ready for school, and he said, well, Mom, what do I do if someone says that to me again? I said, you know, do what you feel comfortable with, but don't accept it. I said, either just walk away or tell them why it's not acceptable. And he came home from school that day, and he told me that it came up again. And he said to the kid, that's not very nice, because you're saying that girls aren't as good as boys. And the kid said it to him again, and in reference to Jake doing something like a girl, and Jake just said, thank you, and walked away.
Awesome.
Thank you for your presentation today. I'm Kathy Hedge, and something you said really resonated with me. I worked with young teachers for a long time, and I remember for the first 10 years of my career, there were so many children that I said, if I could only take them home, they would be doing so much better. And they were, I mean, just dreadful things that people don't understand our children are going through. I mean, very criminal things that we couldn't fix. And so then when I was working with young teachers, I finally learned the story of the starfish, which is that I can't change that child's life. I can report it when I know something illegal is happening, but I can't change it, their life. But for that hour that they are with me, I can try to make it the best part of their day. And so thank you for your positive message of making this the best hour of our day.
What a beautiful framing of that. Thank you.
I think I'm the only economist in the room, so I have to stand up for the concept of scarcity. Scarcity, as it's applied, means that there's not possibly enough to do everything that everybody would want to do. And that's a fact of life. I also want to. I spent a fair amount of my career working with teachers, helping them learn how to integrate economic concepts into their classes, whatever language arts or whatever it happened to be. And one of the things, as they were putting together exercises they had to do to demonstrate what they'd learned, over and over they wanted to include something in their economics class about the difference between wants and needs. Now, as a parent and as a human being, we understand the difference. But economists don't. We don't distinguish between wants and needs. If somebody wants it, that's a values. That's about values. And we certainly encouraged, I did anyway, the teachers to work on values. But don't tell them you're working on economics when you're working on values. It just doesn't fit.
So from a faith perspective, I'll just lift up that I think it is interesting just as a thought process to consider what we're trying to do when we lift up scarcity as a reality and what we think our faith might call us to as far as speaking into that message.
Well, I'm not sure what other people's faith says, but I'm concerned about distributing that scarcity as fairly and as equitably as possible, particularly for those of us for whom scarcity does not have nearly the same meaning
sure.
that it has for people who have so very little.
Excellent.
Okay, please stand as you are able. Our final hymn is 169, We Shall Overcome.
We shall overcome. We shall
overcome. Oh, deep in my heart.
Thank you so much to the choir and to Michael and to Alex and Sarah for your help with this service. I leave you with this thought from journalist I.F. Stone. The only kinds of fights worth fighting are those you are going to lose because somebody has to fight them and lose and lose and lose until someday somebody who believes as you do wins. In order for someone to win an important major fight 100 years hence, a lot of other people have got to be willing, for the sheer fun and joy of it, to go right ahead and fight, knowing they're going to lose. And you mustn't feel like a martyr. You've got to enjoy it. Go in peace.